death case, so of course you have more time. Mainly is to say, please stay in the microphone. I have a bad habit of getting out of the microphone, and after all these years, I still do it. So if you stay in the mic, we can hear you good, and this is recorded, and it'll benefit all of us if you don't waver from the microphone. Other than that, we're ready, and so we call the first case, United States of America versus Snar and Garcia.
Matt, please the court. I'm Doug Barlow from Beaumont, and along with the federal defender, Pat Black, we represent Mr. Snar, one of the co-defendants in this death penalty case. Because of our limitation on time, I'd like to restrict my comments to two particular issues that are similar, almost identical, and that's issues 9 and 10. Those issues deal with the exclusion of potential veneermen on the basis of their disabilities. The trial court excluded veneerman Kimball based upon a minor hearing disability that he expressed, and the trial court excluded veneerman Horton based on a urinary problem that he discussed with the court and the lawyers, counsel at the time of trial. As set out in the briefs for the government and for the appellants in this case, the standard of review is generally in these types of cases an abuse of discretion standard. That's the applicable standard for judging the validity of excluding jurors based upon qualification issues. But I submit that the cited cases that do set out that abuse of discretion standard actually do not go far enough because of the particular unique issues that the record demonstrates in this case.
Now let me ask you this so I understand how you have this issue teed up. Do you make the point that we have sort of concomitant rights here, that the defendant's right to have these jurors on who may have had some disabilities and at the same time the disabled jurors, if you will, have some right that's intersecting here? I mean, I've not seen this issue sort of raised before in the context of a jury selection. In ordinary, when we get, you know, ADA kind of complaints, it's the person with the disability who's asking for the accommodation. So you're arguing that we've got two things going here, the jurors who didn't get accommodated, who otherwise wanted to serve, and they were barred, and at the same time, the defendant's right. I mean, where exactly, where's your argument centered? Whose rights were breached? I know you're arguing on behalf of your client. I don't mean that. But, I mean, where's exactly this reversible error?
It's actually three issues that are coming together, Your Honor. It's the harm that accrues to Mr. Snar, Mr. Garcia, of course, by the exclusion of these jurors. It's the harm that accrues to these individual jurors who have a right. I'm going to discuss a little bit more about that to serve. But some of the case law that discusses discrimination says that that permeates the entire community, purposeful discrimination does. And that's why I think that this case, the standard of review, should go further than just an abuse of discretion standard. And it's much more like the Batson case, and the court should consider a standard review that's of constitutional magnitude.
So the hearing impaired or suspect classification?
I think that not just the hearing impaired, disabled persons in general could be classified as a, and one of the state cases that's cited in the brief even says that persons with such disabilities are entitled to Batson-like protection.
I'm struck by, had the juror been impaneled, what your argument would be on the other side, particularly with respect to the hearing impaired, or the person who said, you know, after 30 minutes, my need to excuse myself interferes with my ability to concentrate. What if these jurors had been impaneled and there was a unanimous verdict? Wouldn't you be here saying?
There are cases. We had a number of alternate jurors. One of the cases,
what's the point of seeing them if you're going to use the alternate juror?
Well, because they haven't been demonstrated to be disqualified. And if we particularly wanted these particular jurors and they wanted to serve, then they should not be the subject of discrimination. If we wanted to raise if we objected to them being placed on the jury because of an impairment, I think the trial court could have overruled that objection unless we could show that somehow impaired their ability. And there are several cases cited in here where someone did exactly that. A defendant later objected, raised an issue on appeal regarding a juror who could not hear and was unsuccessful in that effort because
ineffective assistance of counsel on habeas.
I don't think you could establish that, Your Honor, unless you could show that somehow the juror's impairment affected that juror's ability to assess the evidence.
Well, let's say that the juror says during voir dire, it's my hearing, I can't hear the judge, I can't hear everything that's said at the trial, but I'm going to serve anyway. I mean,
if the record establishes that the person with reasonable accommodations can hear the evidence and can assess the evidence, then I don't think that presents error. That same type of issue has been raised regarding blind persons and pointed out that blind persons have served on juries. Even one of the cases discusses that there's a United States district judge who is a blind judge and is able to make factual determinations and track bench trials. So those disabilities, unless they can be shown to affect the ability to hear the evidence or see the evidence and evaluate the evidence, I don't think it presents error at all. I think if they had been admitted and we would be up here and we were up here arguing that they should not have been, I think that would be an unsuccessful argument. I think what we have here, what we're urging, is similar to the Batson case, that it's purposeful discrimination in this case. It's not even discrimination based foisted upon the defendants or the community by the prosecutor, but the trial judge made it very clear, made statements in the record, including statements like, it doesn't happen here, I just don't want to have somebody that's really handicapped, I can't deal with it. Statements like that shows that it's strictly based on the disability or the judge's perceived perception that these persons should not serve simply because they had some handicap or some disability. We submit that the jurors were qualified and could have applied the law. It's interesting that the government has sought to show that they were excluded for other reasons, but even if they were excluded for other reasons, I don't think it detracts from our argument that they were still purposely discriminated against. The government makes the argument that, I believe it's Mr. Kimball, that he was disqualified and could not participate and assess a death sentence, and their argument for that is that he previously participated and assessed a death sentence in a case. I think that's somewhat of a spurious argument. As I mentioned just before, the exclusion of a juror by a discriminatory practice, it extends beyond the harm inflicted upon the defendants and upon the individual jurors, but also the case law says it touches the entire community. In the Powers v. Ohio case, it's cited in our brief, the United States Supreme Court said, for most citizens, the honor and privilege of jury duty is their most significant opportunity to participate in the democratic process. There's other authority that's set out in the briefs that says any person is qualified unless he or she is incapable by reason of mental or physical infirmity to render satisfactory jury service. And we submit that these persons could render satisfactory jury service. There was no mention.
If you were in the middle of scintillating cross-examination of a key government witness that you had nailed to the wall and the juror raised their hand or indicated otherwise they needed a recess and you really don't want to let this witness off the hook till you get him down and the judge says, time out, you know, we got to take a break here. Would you not be arguing in part that, you know, the judge disrupted the flow of your case, et cetera, you come back on, you know, the witness is geared up and regrouped and now it's fortified against your formidable cross-examination? I mean, doesn't the trial judge have a duty here to make sure there is an even playing field?
I don't know of any, I'm not aware of any case, Your Honor, that's been reversed based on the orderly flow of trial. The trial judge has the authority to control the orderly flow of trial, and I don't think anybody could make an argument that it's reversible error because a break happened at a certain point in the trial. I've had that happen numerous times to my chagrin, where I thought things were going well and all of a sudden there's a break for some reason and might throw us off track. That's just one of the perils of trial law, I think. I don't think I could successfully make that argument. There are numerous state cases. There are no precedent in the Fifth Circuit exactly on this point, but the state cases and the state other authorities, the statutes that all discuss why we should not have this purposeful discrimination are all telling. I think that this is one of those situations that's presented like the Batson case, that there should be no distinction between the prohibition of discrimination based on race and a prohibition against discrimination based on disability. As I said, it permeates the judicial system when this type of purposeful discrimination occurs, and it simply should not be tolerated.
What's the best case you rely on for the proposition that you make in terms of the constitutional violation?
The Batson case. I think this is very similar to the Batson case, Your Honor, that set out the standard that says why we should not discriminate based on race, and we similarly should not discriminate based on disability. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barlow. We'll hear from Ms. Maselli.
May it please the court. Along with Robert Morrow and Gerald Bork, we represent Mr. Edgar Garcia. I'm going to focus my argument on issue 19 and with time on issue 17, which was the exclusion of the extraneous offenses of the complainant. Issue 19 puts me in a very unusual position in arguing that the district court was correct in granting the funding for the experts and investigation required to represent Mr. Garcia, and I'm in the unenviable position of arguing that the former chief judge erred in cutting the budget so drastically. One thing in preparing for this case, $85,000 seems like a lot of money, and it is.
But even assuming the merits are worth or benefits of your argument, I mean, why don't you foreclose, by our case, which says we don't have jurisdiction over that you've either got a mandamus or you basically got to go to Supreme Court. So I'm just saying, assuming that what you say is true, the district court's award was good, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, do we have jurisdiction, given our case, to entertain that or to give you any relief?
Well, I've studied In re Marcum at length. I've dissected it. And one thing it talks about is they could have sought a mandamus or a motion for reconsideration, which the Garcia defense team did. They sought motion for reconsideration. I would also say that 3599 contemplates an appeal when they talk about making it part of the appellate record.
Yeah. As I understand the argument you're making, you're saying that this affected your client's due process, that his inability to get these witnesses,
correct,
however he was unable to get them, affected the due process rights.
Exactly. It was his constitutional right to due process and to effective assistance of counsel to even prepare. And in the government's brief, they aver, well, they never identified a neuropsychologist they would have gotten. They had no money to do that. Although the psychologist recommended, based on her examination of Mr. Garcia, that one would be necessary, when the funding was cut so drastically, there's no way that they could have gone out and got anyone. Chief Judge Jones, former Chief Judge Jones, second order is very strict and severe that do not come back for more money, absent extraordinary circumstances. The day before, the day before trial began, they filed a motion saying take the death penalty off the table because we were denied all of these experts. We can't adequately represent him. And they did have two experts, but Basie, who's the prison expert, he's an expert in how the prison works, and he was a lot of facts based on the guilt-innocence phase of what went down at the prison during that day. But it was the prison expert that was necessary to understand what the institutionalized setting of Mr. Garcia was that would have caused him to think he needed to do what he did. And the same with the neuropsychologist. And in reviewing the order from Chief Judge Jones, not only did she cut the funding, she also said you cannot specifically have a cultural expert. So the order also directed the way Mr. Garcia was going to be defended, how the case would be presented. And
you know, I sympathize with your concern about this, but you, the counsel for the defense in this case, did a very good job of getting the information that he wanted to get from these experts in through other witnesses, it seems to me. So the kind of evidence that you would have gotten from these other, the people that you wanted to hire, came in, for example, through the psychiatric evidence certainly came in through other witnesses.
I think some evidence did come in, I would agree, and this morning I was reading the sealed transcript that Dick Burr and Dr. Haney and Dr. Cervantes testified in. It's USCA 5704, and it really talks about the type of investigation further that was needed, that was unable to be done because of the lack of funding, into his background. I think the prison expert compared to Dr. Haney, who a PhD from Stanford, law degree from Stanford, 25 years understanding the institutionalized setting and what Edgar Garcia's background was, who he was, and also the cultural aspect. I mean, some of it was brought up that he was brought up as a cartel child, but you can tell from the verdict form and the selection form where the jurors, how many found this mitigating? Zero. Zero jurors found all sorts of things not mitigating. And it's because they didn't have the proper experts, they didn't have the ability to present the type of defense contemplated by the Sixth Amendment and contemplated in a federal capital case. I also went through and counted all the witnesses. The government has unlimited experts. They had two prison experts on rebuttal. Snar and Garcia shared one who was factual and came in again at punishment, but they didn't have the expert they requested that Judge Crone felt they needed. When you look at what Judge Crone's findings were, they're very detailed. What was it about her findings that Chief Judge Jones found clearly erroneous? What was it about Judge Crone, who's on the ground level, who's seeing these witnesses, who's tried many cases? I've done a lot of appeals from Judge Crone, and she determined that this was necessary. Those experts were necessary. And to deny him the right to even prepare a proper defense is a violation of due process. It's constitutional in nature, and I don't think Inri Markham somehow obviates all his constitutional guarantees because of a procedural mechanism within the circuit. And the other thing, I was doing a lot of research on abuse of discretion, and it's not a negative, it's not malicious intent, so I don't want the court to think I'm coming here with some sort of, Chief Judge Jones was malicious. I understand people make decisions. It's like a trial court makes a decision, and we come in and grade their paper, and then the three of you come in and grade the paper. But to say that she has unfettered discretion in the direction of a capital case, in the representation of a capital case, it just can't be possible, I would argue, in this case. And the other issue that I would like to briefly discuss is issue 17, where the district court, now I'm going to argue Judge Crone erred, in keeping out the bad acts of the complainant. And the reason I think it's relevant is the government presented a false impression of who the complainant was. While no one deserves to die the way he did, in a prison setting, he had a lot of issues, and he was represented as someone who was pesky, who was annoying, but this is a person who engaged in serious offenses, serious assaults, and none of that came to the jury, and so this false impression really hindered the defense. And you can again look at the selection verdict form. Zero jurors found that Roan engaged in defiant behavior. Zero jurors found his behavior unpredictable. Zero jurors found he displayed a negative and angry approach towards others. But there was all this evidence out there that, in fact, he did do that. And so we believe that the evidence was admissible, it was relevant, and the trial court erred in keeping it out. And if you have no more questions, I'll give my time back to the court.
Thank you.
All right, we'll hear from the government. Ms. Kinner.
May it please the court, counsel. Chris Kinner, assistant United States attorney, here representing the government. I'll take the issues in
in the order that they were presented by the defense counsel. First, moving to the dismissal for physical infirmities, or excusal for physical infirmities, of two of the prospective jurors. I'd like to, before discussing the law, talk a little bit about the process here.
Could you pull that microphone a little closer to you so that I'm not picking up?
Yes, Your Honor. Can you
I'm
hear me now?
I'm impaired for this purpose, so.
Yes, Your Honor. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit about the process that was used here, because I think there's been an unfair portrayal of what the district court actually did in this case. Here we had a juror, she called in actually, it was a very large general panel. It came in on 2 days because they just didn't have enough space to accommodate the courtroom. I pulled one of the forms that are sent to each prospective juror that will come in on one of these pools. And there they are told that qualified individuals with disabilities have the same opportunity and obligation to serve as jurors as people without disabilities. They are further given the opportunity to explain if they have a disability that would affect service but would not prevent it to the court in their juror qualification. In other words, they can make a request for reasonable accommodation before they ever even show up at the courthouse. Now, when the panel showed up on the 2 days, because it was split, the court handed out juror questionnaires that asked various information that was necessary for individual voir dire. One of those questions was, do you have any kind of severe hardship that would prevent your service or would impede your service as a juror? The court told the panel that if you have one of these hardships, we will discuss this with you, we being the court and the lawyers, individually after the questionnaires have been completed. And the court did exactly that. After the questionnaires had been completed, those individuals who listed a hardship, and some of them were job-related, some were family-related, and some were related to physical issues. Those individuals came in and discussed their issues with the court individually and counsel. The court did excuse a number of jurors because they listed physical issues that would affect their service. The defense counsel did not object to a number of those. They did object to several, though. And in fact, and two of them they're arguing about here. After the individual voir dire had been, I mean, after the general voir dire had been completed, the attorneys discussed the matter. They came back to the court and said, out of concerns about the ADA, they urged the court to bring back the jurors that had been excused based on physical infirmities for further questionings regarding their ability. The court did that. She did not bring back the ones that both sides agreed should be excused. But she did bring back every juror who had been excused based on physical infirmity over someone's objection. Then she questioned them, and the two jurors that the defendants now complain about both ultimately requested that they be excused from service based on their physical infirmities. Here, and I believe that there was no abuse of discretion in doing so. First of all, juror number 130, he was also properly excused due to his views of the death penalty. What he did was he told the court that having served on a prior death penalty case would affect his ability to follow his oath and the instructions in this case. He said even though it had been years, he still had dreams about it. He would see the defendant's face, and he didn't think he could assess the death penalty a second time, particularly when there were two people involved. So he very clearly should have been excused for cause, but he also had about a 40% hearing loss. And it was from birth. The way he explained it was he could hear certain voices or tones perfectly, others he really couldn't hear. So, and it was a significant impairment to him. He had when the court reads the record, and I know it will, you'll see that this juror had a very difficult time hearing the court. So even if the court had excused this juror simply on the basis of his hearing, she would not have abused her discretion. Here she did it with his request to be excused, and it was a valid request. He didn't think it could serve. So, and the court does have precedent, not for seating a jury, but we do have at least a couple of cases out of this court where jurors had to be excused or dismissed after deliberations began because of hearing difficulties. So what the trial court did in this case was simply avert that from happening. With respect to juror number 232, that was Mr. Horton, He reported that he was taking a number of medications that caused him to need frequent restroom breaks. The first time he said it had been about five, on the day that he got initially excused, he said it had been about five times in the time he was at the courthouse. When he was called back individually, he had used the restroom about five times in a 2.5 hour period. And he said when he needed to go, it would affect his ability to concentrate. And the trial court, and he did eventually, after talking with the lawyers, request that he be excused based on his infirmity. The trial court didn't abuse her discretion here. She knew, this trial court has tried a number of death penalty cases, and she knew that breaking it into 30-minute segments would lengthen the trial, it would shatter the concentration of the other jurors, it would shatter the concentration of both the witnesses and the lawyers as well as the court, too. So she was well within her means, within her discretion, to dismiss this particular juror, particularly since he requested to be excused. Looking at the legal issues here, the ADA is simply not applicable to the federal judiciary. Therefore, an ADA-based argument is a non-starter. Similarly, the Rehabilitation Act is not applicable to the federal judiciary. So that one also is a non-starter. Under the equal protection argument, there's absolutely no evidence of purposeful discrimination in this case. A person who was handicapped, who showed up in one of those general panels and did not report their handicap as a significant impairment to jury service, would have made it to individual voir dire and been assessed on their views just like anyone else. So the district court did not purposefully discriminate against the qualified handicapped jurors. Turning to the fair cross-section argument, here the defendant would have to show that there was a distinctive group in the community, that they were underrepresented in the voir dire, and that underrepresentation was due to a systematic exclusion in the process. As discussed earlier, there's no systematic exclusion. In fact, handicapped individuals are advised that they are under a duty, obligation, as well as privilege to serve as a juror. So there was no systematic exclusion in the voir dire. There's no indication or no record supporting that they were underrepresented in the voir dire. We have no idea what that general panel looked like as far as handicaps go. We only know the ones that self-reported a handicap. And finally, the defendants assume without any kind of authority that disabled individuals are a distinctive group. And this court knows from its struggles to apply the ADA that is something that is very difficult. You can see the variance here. We have one individual with a hearing impairment and one who takes medication that causes him to need frequent bathroom breaks. It's hard to say that is a distinctive group in the community. So under this analysis, and under the fact that there's just simply no fair cross-section argument. I'll move now to the funding issue. These are issues that we usually do not become involved with. However, it appears under the Markham case that this issue is unreviewable. In the Supreme Court last term, they had the Clare opinion, which analyzed Section 3599, funding for indigent death penalty defendants, with the Criminal Justice Act, 18 U.S.C. Section 3006A. And the court very clearly came down that the analysis under the regular CJA necessarily informs an analysis under Section 3599. It's given their history. At one time, it was only one statute. So to the extent that an analysis would further the purposes of the Death Penalty Act, which was to provide adequate representation for death-qualified individuals, then you can use the standards that were applied to Section 3006A. This court, last February, decided in Ray Markham. And the reasoning underlying Markham would seem to carry over to Section 3599. The court decided in Ray Markham, that the chief judge's decision to reduce funding under 3006A(e)(3) was an administrative decision and not a ministerial one. Well, if that decision under 3006A(3) is administrative, it's difficult to see why it wouldn't also be administrative under 3599F2G2.
Why is it? It seems to me that a direct appeal of that order, Markham covers. But at the end of the day, let's say that Chief Judge Jones had said, I'm not going to give you any money. You know, the end. Never mind what Judge Crone said, the end. At the end of the day, could you not come forward and say, I was unable to call the witnesses and I've been denied due process, and make a case for that? I think that's really what's going on here. This is not a direct appeal of that order. It's an attack on whether or not, as a result of the order, there was a denial of due process, where you'd have to look at the whole situation as it ultimately played out. I mean, I'm not trying to make a case that there was a denial of due process, but I'm saying generically it seems to me that's the claim that's being made here.
I understand that, Your Honor, and we're ready to address the merits as well. Here, Mr. Garcia wasn't denied all funding. Mr. Garcia was given $85,000 for experts and told that he could actually request more. Now, the second order was stricter. It said it'd have to be under extraordinary circumstances. But looking at what happened here, under Aki, the Supreme Court said that indigent defendants must be given a right to present an adequate defense. However, that right is limited. They're given the raw materials, which generally comes in the form of an attorney, and they're not entitled to everything a wealthier defendant can buy. And if the defendant must show that especially a non-psychiatric expert, that the requested expert would assist their defense and that the denial would result in a fundamentally unfair trial. The expert's testimony must be both critical to the defense and subject to varying opinion. There's simply no right to experts on demand. Here, Mr. Garcia was allowed $420,000 for attorney's fees and another $85,000 for experts and investigators. He wanted more. His initial request was around $721,000, $22,000, and the district court cut it to over $600,000. And then the chief judge did cut it some more. The interesting thing from the hearing is that when they came back and asked for more funding after the initial order from Judge Jones and Judge Crone, it was a joint order on September the 11th, they came back and said, we need a prison expert, an expert on Mexican culture, and a neuropsychologist. And the chief judge did allow $20,000 more, but she said no expert on Mexican culture. So the $20,000 could have gone to hiring a prison expert or a neuropsychologist. And then the defendants could have come back and requested more if the need was critical. Here with the neuropsychologist, we have no indication that they ever contacted one. It would seem that $20,000 could have funded at least initial testing to see if there were any organic brain issues that affected Mr. Garcia's behavior. We have no indication that that was done. Had a neuropsychologist said, my initial testing does indicate that there are some issues here, they could have come back to Judge Jones and said, we have an issue, and we need more funding to be able to flesh this out. That didn't happen. There were no further requests. There was simply a motion to dismiss the death penalty because they didn't get the experts. With respect to the expert, the prison expert, Mr. Schnarr had one of those kind of experts. So some of the information, although it was unique to Mr. Schnarr, was before the jury. And interestingly, the jury found no mitigating circumstances with respect to Mr. Schnarr's institutionalization either. So it's unlikely that if it didn't work for Mr. Schnarr, would it have worked for Mr. Garcia? Mr. Schnarr had a longer history in institutions. He had been institutionalized since probably he was around 14, on and off. So it was a longer history than Mr. Garcia's.
Now, what was the series of experts that the government offered?
I checked actually with our administrative office to see what we paid in expert fees. We paid about $5,000, a little bit over, in expert fees in this case.
Total?
Yes, sir. We hired Greg Hirschberger as a rebuttal witness in the selection phase. He is a former warden who at the ADX, and he testified about the ADX program. We also called Christopher Rivers, and Christopher Rivers was, he had been a fact witness because he'd been a prison guard at USP Beaumont, and he had talked about that, and I think he was classified as a fact witness rather than as an expert witness. He did offer some expert testimony, but it didn't cost us any extra, for, at least from what I understand from our admin office. So we weren't really, we didn't have any fancy bells and whistles in this case. We had a lot of witnesses and a lot of evidence, but most of it was about the defendant's history. I don't know what our travel expenses were. I'm sure it cost us a lot to bring witnesses in. But as far as paying experts, it was very little.
But Judge Crone's order was predicated on, you know, knowing the thrust of the prosecution and what the defense would put on, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not quite sure. Did she have a hearing to determine that or decided, made the determination just based on motions? And then the question I have, did the government object or traverse that issue?
Well, Your Honor, we couldn't. That's all done ex parte.
All right.
So we really, had we been asked, we would not have opposed anything they ask. But by statute, we're out of that. We're not in that loop.
Well, I understand in terms of the funding part, but in the ordinary course of trying a case, you know, one side wants to trump out experts, the other side wants to meet it with their expert, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I get that the funding deal here, you know, it's going upstream vertically as far as the chief judge goes, but just in the panoply of trying a case, frequently a judge confronts both sides of one. They've got 99, I got to have 100. In terms of joining the issue so the jury's balanced. So I'm trying to get to the core of this whole prison milieu issue here, and I thought, I guess incorrectly, that I understood that the government had put forth expert witnesses, you know, vis-a-vis this issue, and in part the defendant's request for experts was to try to address that from that standpoint, but I'm getting a different feel from you if you're saying the government did not have a prison expert or whatever it was called?
We didn't deny them a prison expert, and we offered the prison experts that we offered were in rebuttal, and they mainly focused on the issue. It related to future danger, how the defendants would be housed. That's what Mr. Hirschberger was called to discuss. And we didn't offer any kind of evidence on institutionalization of the defendants. We let their record speak for itself. But we did, on rebuttal, feel it necessary to correct the impression left by Mr. Basie that the Bureau of Prisons would simply put Mr. Snar and Mr. Garcia in the control unit at the ADX, a 78-bed unit, and throw away the key. So, and there are some inmates who have been longer in that institution and held there for various reasons, but that's certainly not the norm and that's not the goal of the ADX. And that's, so our evidence was offered to show how the ADX actually works. And now Mr. Rivers, who also, he gave what could be construed as some expert testimony. He works at the ADX, so he talked about how the items work there. It was largely factual as well, and plus he knew Mr. Snar and Mr. Garcia. But he didn't, he wasn't actually really offering expert testimony. He was simply offering testimony to rebut the idea, the notion that they would be held there for any length of time. Looking at the connection, the expert in Mexican culture, it's difficult for Mr. Garcia to meet the standards articulated by this court in Yohei versus Collins, I believe. Because this is a non-psychiatric expert. Here, this expert in Mexican culture, if I understand the testimony that he gave at the hearing, and it was an ex parte hearing, but it's part of the record, and I did read it. It looks like he wanted to offer the fact, show what a typical Mexican family looks like, so that the psychologist can come back and say what the effect of on Mr. Garcia in existing in an atypical family in Mexico. Well, if you look at the evidence regarding Mr. Garcia's family life, which was uncontested, even though some of it was internally contradictory, we didn't contest it. We just let his family talk about whatever they wanted to. And it was atypical for anywhere. It would have been completely atypical for someone in the United States listening to it, or one would hope it would be atypical. So I'm not sure how much value would have been added if this was actually critical to his defense. He also mentioned he talked about the use of alcohol in Hispanic culture, and really there's no evidence that alcohol in any way affected Mr. Garcia's actions on the date in issue, or was even really all that significant in his life. He had been, there was no significant evidence of alcohol abuse there. So it's difficult to see how that particular expert's absence rendered the sentencing hearing for Mr. Garcia fundamentally unfair. Moving very quickly to the evidence regarding Mr. Roan, I think it's very important to keep in mind that the trial court allowed in a tremendous amount of evidence about the victim in this case, and it wasn't good. The only thing that was left out were acts that he had done in other institutions about which the defendants knew nothing. And one of those was a videotape of Mr. Roan in a cell smearing it with feces. During one of the pretrial hearings, one of the counsel for the defense was talking about with the judge. She said that she still needed to watch it. And they said, well, he said, well, don't eat before, because it is a pretty gross tape. The trial judge has discretion under Section 3593E to exclude evidence in a capital sentencing if its probative value is outweighed by the danger of creating unfair prejudice, confusing the issues, or misleading the jury. Here, evidence regarding the victim's bad character was in danger, that the defendants knew nothing about, ran the danger of doing exactly that. There are two primary factors in a federal death penalty sentencing case. First of all, the circumstances of the offense, and second, the character and propensities of the offender. The Supreme Court has allowed victim impact evidence after Payne versus Tennessee, but only because it's perceived to be part of the circumstances of the offense. They've never actually allowed what the defendants are characterizing now as reverse victim impact, where you get to show that the defendant was so bad it's actually mitigating mitigating factor for the killing. But here, the defendants were given a pretty good shot to do exactly that. When the court reviews the entire trial transcript, you'll see that both defendants talked about the victim's bad character in their opening arguments. During the guilt phase, they offered evidence both of Mr. Roan's bad reputation and then of some specific acts and threats that he did that they knew about. Specifically, and the defendants were allowed to offer the testimony of Don Gallagher, who was a prison guard, who testified that about 2 weeks before the murder, Mr. Roan had ejaculated on her shoe. And then they also offered Mr. Roan's cellmate, Mr. Palaret, who talked about how he was manipulative, controlling, disruptive. They did not paint a good picture of Mr. Roan at all, and we really didn't offset that. During the closing arguments at the guilt phase, both defendants were allowed to argue that Mr. Roan had actually caused this murder. Then during the selection phase, Mr. Schnarr's expert talked about some specific threats that Mr. Roan had supposedly made, and those threats were based on testimony that was very highly impeached, but she talked about it nonetheless. Mr. Palaret testified about specific acts that Mr. Roan had allegedly done. The district court simply refused to allow, when they made an offer of proof at the end of the selection phase, evidence of Mr. Roan's actions in other United States penitentiaries that the defendants knew nothing about. During the closing arguments, it's interesting, in talking about Mr. Roan's character, our lead counsel acknowledged that Mr. Roan was exactly the kind of person that he would like to prosecute. And he followed up with, he was obnoxious, he was loudmouthed, and he was stupid, and it got him killed. That's what the evidence indicates here, and the jury had a very clear picture of how bad Mr. Rohn was. I don't think anyone left that courtroom thinking that Mr. Rohn was an upstanding character or a normal victim, as you one would perceive it. Here the trial court didn't abuse their discretion by keeping out some highly prejudicial evidence that could not have affected the defendant's actions. They didn't know about it. It didn't support a recognized defense, and it didn't show the circumstances of the offense or the character or propensities of the defendants. Therefore, it was properly deleted. Unless the court has any further questions about any other issues, I will submit the remainder of the issues as briefed and respectfully urge the court to affirm both the conviction and the death sentence.
I do have one question. Counsel on the other side argued today that the jury, zero jurors found a number of mitigating factors not mitigating. Do you have any response to that?
When the court reviews the form, the jurors did actually find a number of mitigating factors as well. Mr. Snarr submitted 68 mitigating factors, and the jury found that 11. Various members of the jurors found 11. With Mr. Garcia, he submitted 86 mitigating factors, and various members of the jury found, I think, 11 of those as well. And they found different things. The thrust of this defense there was really twofold. Number one was the victim needed killing, and number two was if BOP had done its job, this never would have happened. That was the primary thrust of the defendant's defense. And when you look at the mitigation, they did get some traction with that. The mitigators found by the jury actually do relate to those issues, to BOP failing to follow policies, and to
But had there been expert evidence on some of the mitigating factors, might not it been a different scenario?
They did present, well, first of all, it's not they on this issue, Your Honor, because Mr. Snarr got to present everything he wanted to present, and he did it fully. So, but with respect to Mr. Garcia, it's difficult to see how the lack of the experts actually affected his defense. A Mexican cultural expert showing that his family life was atypical, that really wouldn't have gotten
him. What about a neuropsychologist?
The neuropsychologist, again, if he had anything organically wrong with him, then that would have been valuable information for the jury to know. However, the jury had an overwhelming amount of evidence regarding Mr. Garcia's actions. They got to see him on tape, and they got to hear witnesses talk about things he had done and things he had said. So the jury had a fairly accurate depiction of Mr. Garcia. So would a neuropsychologist have helped this? If it would have, it's hard to believe that they wouldn't have gotten testing with the $20,000 additional dollars that they were given, and at least enough to come back to the chief judge and ask her for more, or if she declined to give them more, to file a petition for writ of mandamus to the Supreme Court. If the court has no further questions, then I will conclude.
Anything else? All right, thank you. Back to you, Mr. Barlow.
Just have some brief remarks and follow up to some of those issues. Regarding our two jurors who were excluded, Mr. Kimball was a vacillating juror at best, and Mr. Horton began by saying he would love to serve when he first showed up. So I submit that in itself, whether or not the court had some other reason for excluding him, it's the fact of what the court said that's also important. And I was just thinking by analogy, if the court intended to excuse a juror who had some particular type of bias, said, I'm going to excuse this juror because this juror is biased. And by the way, that juror is Hispanic also, so that's why I'm going to excuse that juror. Nobody would be here arguing that would be permissible. It's the permeation of this purposeful discrimination that's the issue here, not whether or not there was some other reason or whether or not Mr. Horton was finally talked into saying, yes, I'd My urinary problem may present a problem. It's the fact that the court specifically stated on the record the purposeful discrimination. There's no interpretation here when the court made statements like, I can't deal with that. I mean, he's had it since birth. He's had a problem. Well, that's true with a lot of people with hearing problems. And there were no accommodations that were offered whatsoever. And they could have been very easy accommodations that could have been offered. I took the stand as a witness to when we were questioning Mr. Kimball and spoke in a voice like I'm speaking right now and said, can you hear me? This is all in the record. He said, yeah, I can hear you fine right now. I just have a problem hearing the judge sometimes. And it's acoustics like some of these courtrooms with high ceilings. Sometimes we have to use microphones.
But Judge Crone's voice is much higher and softer than yours as well.
That is correct. And I have problems hearing her sometimes. So I have to be careful, make sure I'm understanding what she's saying. But we have microphones. We have things that...
Well, I thought he said even with the microphone, he couldn't hear the judge.
He said he had some problems. But if the judge speaks up, then that problem could be alleviated. I've had a number of trials, where jurors might raise their hand and say, I didn't hear that witness, and that problem can be alleviated. But I've had trial judges say, did y'all hear that witness? The witness is speaking softly. And so those problems, those are minor accommodations that can deal with these particular things. Some of the state cases that are cited in our brief even address these particular issues. In the Galloway versus the Superior Court of D.C., that was where the court, the defendant in that particular case, was because a court court excluded a blind person, and the federal court that heard that particular case found that the exclusion of a blind person violated the Rehabilitation Act, the ADA, the Civil Rights Act of 1871, and actually provided a cause of action against that trial judge for a violation of 42 U.S.C. section 1983. And the court said something that's very important by analogy here. The court said the defendant's policy, and that's the trial judge's policy, toward deaf jurors evidences a lack of prejudice towards those with hearing impairments and demonstrates their ability to look behind archaic stereotypes thrust upon disabled persons. It is thus difficult to fathom why the policy differs toward blind jurors. This is just the converse of that situation. This is where this court has specifically stated its purposeful discrimination and upholding those archaic stereotypes and excluding persons who have some disabilities. We think that the defendants, the jurors, and the community at large had a right to a trial free from purposeful discrimination. It has no place in a courtroom, and it violates the Constitution. We submit just as the facts underlying the Batson case. There's no distinction. It has no place in the judiciary, and for those reasons, we urge that these causes be reversed.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Barlow. Ms. Micella.
May it please the court. The U.S. attorney stated that they would not have opposed the request for experts. And I appreciate that. And it was ex parte, and it was Judge Crone who determined that they were necessary. And one thing I want to point out is that the cultural expert, we don't have a full record of what he would have discovered. We had a preliminary testimony of he thought more work needed to be done regarding the relationship between the culture and the mental health of Mr. Garcia. So we just
what was the proffer for that expert?
The proffer was they had his resume and he had reviewed some medical records, and I believe he may have spoken with Mr. Garcia, but he said, look, I need to do a full depth, in-depth evaluation, and that's what they needed the money for him to do a complete evaluation, and he didn't.
All right, so what was the hypothesis for the expert testifying? What was the defense hypothesis? That's my terminology. But in other words, you're asking for an expert. You want an expert on fingerprints, we all know what that is. But if you're asking for something atypically like some of these areas, not a psychiatrist, for example, a medical doctor. So I'm saying, putting it to Judge Crone, you say, I want an expert who is X, who we want in order to render an opinion about what?
Well, it was Dr. Jolie Brams who testified that she felt to further represent in mitigation Mr. Garcia, he needed a cultural expert, and you're asking why. Mr. Garcia's background was very unique. In the hearing, and Judge Crone said, well, what if he was Irish-American? Would that be similar? And the expert said, well, if the family was just over from Ireland and perhaps they're culturally still there, the explanation of the Bruja and the witches and the way he wasn't wanted at birth, I don't pretend to fully understand it. I read just what's in the record. Maybe if he had completed his evaluation, I would be able to tell you
And I'm not quarreling with it. I'm trying to understand it in the context of we had a lot of death cases, most of them habeas. And in the sentencing phase, you know, there's lots of testimony in the mitigation vis-a-vis school records. You know, child dropped, you know, a lot as a child, drugs, alcohol, fetal syndrome. We see a lot of that. And so people will come in a death case, say, I need an expert to testify about X. Okay, well, then the judge has a sense of at least what you are trying to show. You may not know the answers. And so I'm trying to get a better handle on what was the defense's proffer of what this expert will show and how it's going to be connected to this defense. So is it to what? Demonstrate that the behavior vis-a-vis the crime is anchored to atypical characteristics that might arise in a Mexican culture that the jury, without an expert, because we say with an expert witness, it's for something that the jury can't figure out, right?
Right.
Okay, so I'm trying to figure out what is it?
I think what it would be is to understand where he came from and what his background led him to where he was at the time of the offense. At the time of the offense, he was serving 480 months. What about him being brought up and in Mexico, in a drug cartel family? What about that? The jury wouldn't understand, because it wouldn't be typical to their background, probably. So I think that is why Dr. Bram said they needed the cultural expert. She felt they needed the neuropsychological expert because there might have been some organic brain disorder.
And
she
why wasn't some of that money used at least to do preliminary neuropsychological testing?
Now that, there was $20,000 additional, but when I looked at the budget, when it talked about neuropsychological, the line item said $45,000. The record is unclear. But it should demonstrate that that money wasn't just for experts. They had to pay for all the investigation as well, so any sort of fact investigation. And there just probably wasn't enough money to do that when you weigh it all out and they asked for it twice. The other expert, and I want to make clear, the prison expert, it wasn't so much what goes on up in Florence, Colorado. It was what about this institutional setting makes it less or more sympathetic to Mr. Garcia, why he acted the way he did the day of the murder. And we would ask the court to
Don't go anywhere, because I got an interest in this, because something tells me I'm going to see this question barreling down at me in other contexts, so I want to understand the drill here. On my time, here's the deal here. There's a line between asking for an expert in order to establish X, and then there's another line between asking for something which at best could be characterized as fishing. It's highly speculative, and it's not a bright line. And so somewhere in here, you know, it seems, and I've been listening carefully for it, the linchpin between I need an expert for X in order to establish yada yada versus I need an expert in hopes that somebody can do something out here which may be highly speculative. And so all I'm trying to nail you down to, not getting into the merits of what Chief Justice Jones decided or not, but just so I firmly understand, particularly in light of what Judge King raised, if it's a due process question, I want to make sure I understand where the request for the expert and what it purported to prove in terms of the defense cuts into due process versus a no harm in asking for an expert that we can't say what they might say, and there's a dollar tag, which to me is just, you know, it's a discretionary call on how much you get. And that was a long-winded way of saying it, but all I want you to do is to succinctly tell me, you know, what the proffer was for in terms of establishing defense that you feel was the due process violation.
Dr. Jolie Brams, who did interview Mr. Garcia and did do an evaluation, came with the conclusion that those three experts were necessary.
Okay.
Thank you.
I can't say that wasn't a succinct answer. I've never seen counsel wanting to get away from that microphone so fast. All right. We have the briefs on it and the record, and we will do our due diligence with it. I do want to say, CJA counsel, we do appreciate as a court the work that's done that may or may not show up in terms of vouchers and all that sort of thing, but I promise you institutionally we value very highly the work that you do on behalf of clients in extraordinarily difficult cases. And so you just need to know that, and hopefully you communicate it to other people who take on these cases against some extraordinary obstacles, and I don't mean in terms of evidentiary, but they're just tough cases to deal with. So we thank you. We have it. We'll go through it, and we'll decide it expeditiously. Thank you.